There is no circumstance, no trouble, no testing that can ever touch me until, first of all, it has gone past God and past Christ right through to me. If it has come that far, it has come with a great purpose, which I may not understand at the moment. But I refuse to become panicky as I lift up my eyes to Him and accept it as coming from the throne of God for some great purpose of blessing to my own heart. That's worth thinking about. And now we're turning to Job tonight and chapter 15. And I intend to even go further than the notes tonight and do chapter 16, but chapter 16 not in great depth, but particularly our chapter 17 and those 16 verses of chapter 17. But we'll be doing in detail chapters 15 and 16 this evening, and then looking at the finish of Job's argument in chapter 17. I must say that I have found these chapters very difficult, but I do believe that God has given some light for us on a message for all of your hearts. So though maybe for a little while, those of you who are listening by tape now and joining us by tape, you may find it hard going and wonder what on earth is happening and where it's going, you be patient, because there is a message from God for you tonight in these chapters. I have never in my life heard these chapters dealt with publicly. I wish I had, then perhaps I could help you a lot more. But I find that very few preachers ever in public will tackle these chapters. But that is our task in the will of God tonight. Not that we're any better than they are, but we're going to tackle them in public. Now, we're not going to read the whole chapters through. We're going to go down it verse by verse, but chapter 15, 1 to 3 to start with. Then answered Eliphaz the Temanite and said, "Should a wise man utter vain knowledge and fill his belly with the east wind? Should he reason with unprofitable talk or with speeches wherewith he can do no good?" Well, this is the beginning, friends, of a second round of speeches. We've been through the first round over the last 2 months. And as Job became more vehement, his friends became more severe and harder on him. Now, at first, Eliphaz, if you remember in the series past, was very gentle and very courteous with Job, because he felt Job was a great man, a wonderful man of God. Job had a great reputation, not only in heaven, but on earth. He was a rich man, a famous man, a wise man. And because he was venerated by Eliphaz, at the start Eliphaz was very courteous and very kind to him. But you'll notice in this chapter his courtesy has flown away. He's not kind to him anymore. Because if at first his great reputation had held him back and he'd given Job the benefit of the doubt, here he now just opens up full barrels on him and he accuses him of irreverent talk. Notice what he says in verse 2. "Should a wise man utter empty knowledge?" You're talking a lot of empty nonsense. "Should he fill his belly with the east wind?" Your speeches, Job, are like somebody belching, as far as I'm concerned. And as far as Eliphaz is concerned, Job's claims to wisdom are pointless. Now, the way Eliphaz begins to really move in on poor Job gives me the impression here in this passage that he's been hurt by what Job has said. And it's like an Irish friend of mine says, when you chuck a brick at a lot of dogs, it's the one that gets hit that yelps the most. And I know what he means. Job really got fed up with with the mere theological talk of these men and their platitudes. And he said a few things which were the truth, but Eliphaz got hit, and he was hurt. And in verse 2 and in verse 3, he really now comes out and says, should he reason, would a wise man, verse 3, reason with unprofitable talk, or with speeches wherewith he can do no good? I have said in number 1 in your note sheet, Eliphaz dismisses Job's speeches as unprofitable talk, which he will not dignify by debating. What's the point in arguing with you, Job? Because you're just empty wind. And Job, of course, had claimed to have as much understanding as his other three friends had, and know as much as they did about spiritual things. Not that he was claiming to have a monopoly on the truth, but he said, I know as much as you men do. And he dismissed Job's claim to that. And of course, he contradicts Job's claim that he knows as much as they do. Now let's move from verse 4 to verse 6. Yes, thou castest off fear and restrainest prayer before God, for thy mouth uttereth thine iniquity, and thou choosest the tongue of the crafty, and thine own mouth condemneth thee, and not I. Yes, thine own lips testify against thee. The things that you have said, Job, have condemned. You have condemned yourself out of your own mouth. And in fact, in these verses, he is really, notice verse 5, he is really claiming that the words that Job had been talking gave away a deep-seated iniquity that he had down in his heart. Verse 5, thy mouth uttereth thine iniquity. You're a sinner, Job, and you know it, and you haven't truly lived for God, and you've condemned yourself, you're irreverent in the things you have said about God, and you've chosen the tongue of the crafty, and your own mouth condemns you. He says, Job, you're not only stupid in your talk, but you're dangerous. Your words are a threat to spirituality. Notice that he says in verse 4, Job, you've even banished the fear of God from your mind with some of the things you have said. You have no fear of God before you. You're just pouring all this thing out, and it's dangerous talk, all these ideas you have. And Job, you're doing an awful lot of harm, mainly to yourself. You're your own worst enemy. You're condemning yourself. Don't worry about us so much. It's yourself you're giving away. Notice that, as is usual with the speakers in this tremendous controversy we've been studying, he commences his argument with personalities. And only gradually does he come down to the theology that he feels is the answer to Job's problem. And he's taken up with Job's personality. And Job has so diminished devout meditation and reverent thoughtfulness and the awe and the modesty that a man ought to have in the presence of God. He says, look at you. You have cast off fear and restrainest prayer before God. You hinder devotion to God in the way you are talking. That there is no longer any need to scrutinize your life for any proof of your guilt, Job. You're guilty. And we don't need to produce any definite charges that you have asked us to charge you with. You've condemned yourself. We don't need to charge you. Your own mouth has proved you to be a great sinner. And all that his friends had alleged against him over all of these discussions, he's now admitted. He says, you have now admitted with your own tongue. Your tongue is your problem. It's an unruly member, Job. And it is undisciplined. And it's violent. And it's irreverent. And thine own mouth condemneth thee. And then by a string of humiliating questions from the 7th verse to the 16th verse, he shakes Job to the very root of his personality. He just pours out at him question after question after question. Mind you, this is pretty tough stuff. It was hard to take for a man very ill. A man with dreadful problems. Nightmares and hallucinations and ulcerations and problems within. Physical problems and depressions. Poor Job. Now he has a shake to the very roots as this man goes for him. He said, art thou the first man that was born, verse 7? Or wast thou made before the hills? Hast thou heard the secret of God, and dost thou restrain wisdom to thyself? What knowest thou that we know not? And what understandest thou which is not in us? With us are both the grey-headed and the very aged man, much elder than thy father. Are the consolations of God small with thee? Is there any secret thing with thee? Why doth thine heart carry thee away? And what do thy eyes wink at? Why are your eyes angry? That thou turnest thy spirit against God, and lettest such words go out of thy mouth? What is man that he should be clean? And he which is born of a woman, that he should be righteous? Behold, he putteth no trust, that is, God putteth no trust in his saints. Yea, the heavens are not clean in his sight. How much more abominable and filthy is man, which drinketh iniquity like water? Well, this first question is very sarcastic. Tell me, Job, he said, were you the first man on the earth? And of course, people believed in that day that the earlier you were to the creation of man, the more you would know about the mysteries of the earth. So that knowledge which you had handed down to you that came from those who lived right at the beginning of creation, they would know the great mysteries. Are you like that, Job? Are you the first man on the earth? And here we have this rather sarcastic statement made with regard to verse number 8. Art thou 7, verse 7, art thou the first man that was born, or wast thou made before the hills? Hast thou heard the secret of God? Tell me, Job, do you sit in the cabinet of heaven? Who do you think you are? And I'm told that that image in that verse number 8 is taken from the Oriental divan, where the Oriental ruler would sit with his cabinet and they would discuss state secrets on that divan. And the sarcastic insinuation here is that no man could be as wise as Job pretended to be unless he had actually been in the council chamber of God himself. So these fellows aren't nice to Job anymore. They really feel he's guilty. And he has condemned himself. And they are pouring on the sarcasm. The problem is, of course, you see, that Job didn't claim to have a monopoly of knowledge. What a dreadful pity that this man, instead of bearing with his friend's infirmity and sympathizing with his sorrows, that he should take this mocking and sarcastic attitude with poor Job. Maybe there's a lesson in that for you and I when we're counseling those that we feel to be in error. But verse 11 to verse 16, it seems to me that Eliphaz's phrases and supply of ideas are beginning to run out. He's getting short of ideas. There's little new in all this running commentary and remonstration that he's now giving to Job. Little new that we haven't seen before in our studies. You, Job, he says, should be satisfied with the consolations of God. Verse 11. Are the consolations of God small with thee? Do you not realize that what we've been teaching you, fellow, we have got from the Lord? And you should be satisfied with it. You should be assured that in God's name, we have given you the right thing. And if you'd only repent of your sin now and start praying, you'd be all right. Confess your guilt, renounce your guilt, and you'll get all your wealth back and you'll get your health back and all the rest of it. And Eliphaz complacently purrs on, unfortunately forgetting that whatever praises itself, but in the deed, devours the deed in the praise. He starts to praise himself for all the help that he has given to him. And he demolishes that deed by his praise of the deed. Perhaps in these verses down here, in verse 12, you would almost think that Job had got really angry with him and that he could see Job's anger coming out of his eyes, because he begins to almost start, "Are the consolations," verse 11, "of God small with thee? And is there any secret thing with thee? Why doth thine heart carry thee away? Why are you carried away?" And as the NIV has it, "Why do your eyes flash?" Or as another translation I read was, "Why do your eyes kindle with anger?" Here it is in the King James, "What do thy eyes wink at?" He seems to jump to this, although he doesn't say anything at this stage. And then he gets really angry with him. "Why does your heart carry you away? And why do your eyes wink with anger?" And in verse 13 he says, "That thou turnest thy spirit against God and lettest such words go out of thy mouth." And really, honestly, friends, these two men are going in two parallel lines. Job is sure that he's innocent, as he actually is. Eliphaz is convinced that because of his sin, that's why all these troubles have come on him, and he's trying to go along that line. And they're two parallel lines, and they're not going to meet. And as long as they're both on these two lines, they're never going to meet. And in verse 14, he really hurls back Job's statement at him. You remember Job had said that man who is born of woman is a few days and full of trouble. He says, "What is man that he should be clean?" Verse 14. "And he which is born of woman that he should be righteous." He casts Job's talk back in his teeth. The inevitable impurity of a man that is born of a woman. He strikes poor Job with his own weapon, convicting him out of his own mouth. And then in verse 15, he quotes himself, almost with pomposity. He quotes himself, as we have heard him quoting later on, or earlier, or saying, here he quotes it in verse 15. "Behold, he putteth no trust in his saints, yea, the heavens are not clean in his sight. How much more abominable and filthy is man which drinketh iniquity like water." If even those who follow the Lord are not consistently following the Lord and have sin within them, then how much do you think you are, Job, he's insinuating. The impurity of the very heavens above us in God's sight, the frailty of the very angels, as if to show that Job had not yet mastered the very first lesson that Eliphaz had tried to teach him. Look, even the heavens are marked by the fall. Even angels have fallen. What hope do you have? "Men drink iniquity like water." Some statement that, isn't it? And it is true that very often that is true of the world in general, that they do drink sin like water. But he's going too far in this argument. In verse number 16, he draws the inevitable inference that from these premises he set down, that if the heavens and the angels aren't impeccable, how much less man? And of course, he intends Job to make this application to himself and to see his own face in this glass that he's held up to him. And let his reason and his conscience say what they will. You must be loathsome, Job, in God's sight and possessed by an insatiable thirst for iniquity. It was a very gross libel against this great man, given by what I believe to be one of the most spiritual of Job's friends. It was a gross lie. For while this man sits here in all of these verses depicting poor Job as being loathsome and unclean to God, God was actually boasting about Job as being a perfect and an upright man. And so far from lusting after evil, he actually turned away from it. And what we know now about Job's innocence, Job felt as Eliphaz poured out all this stuff to him. And then Eliphaz feels Job needs a fresh reminder of the fate of the wicked. And in verse number 17 to verse number 35, he really opens up on a second harangue against this godly man. Eliphaz returns and expands the point that he had touched on in verse number 10 about with us, that is on our side, are the gray-headed and the very aged men, much older than your father. And the fellows who back us up, Job, in our argument, are all the great men. And oh, how often I have heard that used against young Christians, sometimes who are accused falsely. And sometimes even error is taught out of mere tradition of men. Not based upon God's truth, but because, well, our fathers did it, or our grandfathers did it, or it was always done this way. And after all, he's been 40 years on the road, and he ought to know. As my friend Rowley Pickering says, he might be 35 of those 40 years in the road. And I know what he means. But sometimes it is so true that people think that true spirituality comes because you have been a Christian for so long, or known the Lord so long. And yet sometimes little boys and girls and young folk who come to know the Lord just a year or two have as much knowledge and go even further than other people progress in a whole lifetime. True spirituality doesn't always come with age. Not that we are not to respect old age and listen to older people when they have truth to teach us, but make sure the truth they're teaching you is based on the Word of God and not mere tradition of men, or it'll take you away further than you ever dreamt and take away your joy. Check everything with the Word of God, whether it be antiquity or in the modern day. Check it with God's Word. And you know, if I had been Job listening to this, I'd have given in and said, okay, you're right, absolutely right. I would have bent to the pressure that came from verse 17 to verse number 35, because it's very formidable. He now begins to formally appeal to the wisdom of antiquity, to the sages of old time, just as certain modern divines that I know of are always quoting the fathers of the past, you know, hoping that he may handle this argument more successfully than Bildad had tried to bring this over to Job in chapter 8. But he felt, perhaps now Eliphaz felt, he could get it in even harder than Bildad did. He might reinforce it by citing another and a more authoritative series of traditions. For while Bildad appealed to the wise men of Egypt, you remember that in the past, Eliphaz now, from verse 17 to 35, begins to present to poor Job a whole string of proverbs handed down from the ancient sages of the purest blood Arabian races, with whom he was very familiar. He is presenting an argument that the wicked, that is from 17 to 35, even though they be great in prosperity, they know they're finished. And they know there's a terrible impending doom hanging over them. And he's trying to say in these verses, the wicked know that trouble is coming, Job. And now he begins to use all these proverbs from the ancient Arabian tradition to back it home. These Arab fathers and their maxims, they had expressed this view of the lot of the wicked, and now he's trying to do it. Some affirm that the dogma which these sayings illustrate is actually in Arabia and in Arab lands today still a tradition, and they illustrate the whole ruling theme of Arabian thought even to this very day. What comes in these verses? They believe this, and this is the kind of maxims they live by. But whatever the derivation of these proverbs we're about to read, they are the answer of Eliphaz to Job's contention that Luke, Job says, it's the wicked who prosper. And it's the truly godly man in life who seems to suffer the most. The one who truly wants to know the Lord and truly wants to do God's will, they are the ones often who have the greatest trouble, while the wicked have a great time. And of course, Christians here tonight know what I'm talking about, that what Job is trying to say is still true. The wicked get off with their sins, the wicked prosper every day across the country. It's the Christian who's persecuted. I met a man but yesterday in Scotland who told me that he had to, in a certain shop with a certain manager who was trying to go in for bribery and corruption. And he said, no, I'm not going to do it. And he turned around and he said, you are a miserable sod. He said to my Christian friend, who is a lovely Christian, he said, you can call me what you like, sir, but I'm not doing it. And he was sitting down at tea, and we were sitting together, and he says, Derek, he's driving a fabulous Rover car, you know. You want to see the suits he's got on? Not that if you have a Rover, you've been fiddling the books. The Lord bless you if you've got it. But, you know, it was a living example of what I'm talking about now. Here was a fellow who was doing his job, and he would not go in for bribery and corruption. And he said, there he is, he said, and he's prospering. He's making a lot of money, and I know how he's doing it. But I'm not going with him. And he was sort of pointing almost to his own suit, you know. And that's true. Maybe some of you here tonight are really facing that in work or whatever. And the others seem to prosper, while you who live for God's standards, you seem to suffer the slings and the arrows of misfortune. And now, of course, from 17 to 35, he is now beginning to get into these Proverbs, and he's really trying to say, Job, you're wrong. It's the wicked who do not prosper. It's the godly who are the rich men. And because you're not rich any longer, that's because you're not godly. Verses 17 to verse 19 are really a solemn preface by which he prefixes this collection of quotations. I will show thee, hear me. And that which I have seen, I will declare, which wise men have told from their fathers and have not hid it, unto whom alone the earth was given, and no stranger passed among them. This is pure Arabian tradition, handed down, told from the fathers, that hasn't been hid, unto whom alone the earth was given. And then from verse 20 to verse 24, we have some interesting expressions which aren't all that difficult or aren't all that easy to explain. He begins these little maxims. The wicked man, he says, verse 20, travaileth with pain all his days, and the number of years is hidden to the oppressor. The wicked man suffers torment. The ruthless through all the years stored up for him is another translation. A dreadful sound is in his ears. In prosperity, the destroyer shall come upon him. He believeth not that he shall return out of darkness, and he is waited for of the sword. He wandereth abroad for bread. That's the wicked man saying, where is it? The wicked man's always in need, you see. Here's another little quotation. He wandereth abroad for bread, saying, where is it? He knoweth that the day of darkness is ready at his hand. Trouble and anguish shall make him afraid. They shall prevail against him as a king ready to the battle. Can I read that? In the NIV, terrifying sounds fill his ears. When all seems well, marauders attack him. He despairs of escaping the darkness. He's marked for the sword. He wanders about, food for vultures. He knows the day of darkness is at hand. Distress and anguish fill him with terror. They overwhelm him like a king poised to attack. And of course, the insinuation here is, you see, Job has been attacked by terrorists. Job lost all his servants because the marauders came and killed him. And, of course, he lost all his animals that way, and his 3,000 camels, etc., and all his caravans and all the rest of it. I mean camel caravans. He lost it all through terrorism. And the insinuation is, you see, you must be wicked, Job, you see, because this is the sort of thing that our fathers tell us happened to the wicked. They have seen it, you see, they know. And poor Job, you know, he's listening to this. It sounds so plausible. The destroyer is the raider. You see, the destroyer mentioned in these verses is the raider. And the insinuation is that poor Job is wicked because these things have happened to him. The very idea that the wicked fear to walk in the dark because they're scared that those they have wronged will come out and kill them. They're lying in wait for them with a sword. That seems to be the meaning of these verses. And then from verse 25 to verse 27, this restless and haunted conscience of the wicked man is traced to the full-fed, arrogant opposition of wicked people to God. Notice verse 25. Why is he like this? Why is he afraid? Why is he frightened somebody will kill him? Why does he constantly have this fear over his head? Because he stretcheth out his hand against God, verse 25, and strengtheneth himself against the Almighty. He runneth upon him even on his neck, upon the thick bosses of his bucklers, because he covereth his face with his fatness and maketh collops of the fat on his flanks. You say, what on earth does that mean? Well, it's fascinating language, isn't it? Well, these fellows are acting, he says. These wicked people are acting like heroes against God. They actually charge God. Notice that. They stretch out their hands. And in verse 26, they run upon God, even on his neck, upon the thick bosses of his bucklers. What an image. They're always charging against God. They think they're going to bring God down. The wicked show themselves to be self-indulgent. In verse 27, their sides bulge with fat. Because they're eating too much. They're self-indulgent people and they're opposed to God. And then we come to verse number 28, which is one of the most difficult verses in this chapter to expound. That's how they act up to verse 27. As if they were a warrior attacking God. They're fat, they're self-indulgent. Verse 25, though his face is covered with fat and his waist bulgeth with flesh. What's going to happen to him? Verse 28, he dwelleth in desolate cities and in houses which no man inhabiteth, which are ready to become heaps. Now what does that mean? The wicked man, according to this Arabian tradition, traditional proverb, he dwells in desolate cities, empty cities, and houses which no man inhabiteth. What does that mean? Well, I'm told that the poet is actually describing a condition that happens in Arabian lands. I am told that in history there are cities which God seems to have stricken down. I think Petra, the great city with the houses walled or cut into the rock, was left desolate. And many of these Arabian people believed it was because of the wickedness in those cities. Problems came, armies came against them, the divine will was against them, and these cities became like ghost towns. And these villages became like ghost towns. God judged them and cursed them for the crimes of their former inhabitants. And such an act was held by the Arabs to be nothing short of a public and deliberate defiance of the Almighty whenever wicked people walked into these desolate cities and started to live in them. They were defying God. And I believe that that is possibly the explanation of that verse. He dwelleth in desolate cities. Cities that God has judged. They go and live in such villages and cities ruined by frequent judgments are common, I'm told, to this very day in the Arabian desert. And of course, here's an Arab maybe even today on his way to Mecca, and he'll rush through these cities. He wouldn't even stop. He's sort of praying to God the whole way through, and he's rushing on. He won't even stop. Because God has judged those cities, not daring to linger, lest he should provoke the divine wrath of heaven. Ah, but these wicked fellows, they don't worry about that. They just go in and live there. I suppose it's a bit in a sense like today when whenever we see wickedness defying God, breaking into tombs, as we had it in Belfast recently, people breaking into tombs and stealing. And we have even people desecrating buildings like this. Up in Craigavon at the moment, I believe they're having real problems with it, where buildings given over to worship are being pasted by young people and bricks and all the rest of it, desecrating the place. And because of that, we fear for those who would dare to touch that which is God's. And that's the feeling behind this verse. He dwelleth in desolate cities and in houses which no man inhabiteth, which are ready to become heaps. To dwell in such a city would be regarded by the Arabs with horror as a sin so insolent and so enormous as to be almost incredible. And then the favorite image of the wicked, always used by these men so often to Job in verse 29 and 30. The favorite image of the wicked as that which grows and withers. Notice it. He shall not be rich, neither shall his substance continue, neither shall he prolong the perfection thereof upon the earth. He shall not depart out of darkness, the flame shall dry up his branches, and by the breath of his mouth shall he go away. And Eliphaz, you know, who began by calling Job a windbag and just belching speeches, ends his own speech from verse 32 to 35 with a whole pile of verbiage. Tedious repetition. He presents the doctrine again that he's been at for so long. Job, you reap what you sow, fella. And away he goes again. Let not him that is deceived, verse 31, trust in vanity. That's vanity can be translated evil as well. For vanity and evil shall be his recompense. You reap what you sow. It shall be accomplished before his time, and his branch shall not be green. He shall shake off his unripe grape as the vine, and shall cast off his flower as the olive. For the congregation of hypocrites shall be desolate, and fire shall consume the tabernacles of bribery. They conceive mischief and bring forth vanity or evil, and their belly prepareth deceit. The wicked here are like palms, like grapes, like olives that never come to fruitage. He's back to where he started. Eliphaz cannot ever even admit the fact, the frequent fact, of the untrammeled prosperity of the bad and the unrelieved misery of the good, let alone reconcile it with the justice of God. But this time he's been more severe. This time he's really, as we say, bombed in on Job. And he has brought the tradition of his family and tribe and elders and grandfathers and great-grandfathers and great-great-grandfathers right back down through the age to say, Job, you're a sinner, fellow. Admit it, and your problems will be over. Incredible. There's the fate of the wicked, Job. You just remember where the wicked end. He's threatening them with hell, isn't he, in these verses. Well, Job, I wonder how he's going to react. You know this famous character that has gone around the world recently quoting Mark's gospel from beginning to end? The actor. He learned 3 verses a day. And over the years, he can now say Mark's gospel. And I'm told when he comes out in the theater, he lays the New Testament down in front of him and says, just in case, I need it. But he can quote it from beginning to end. I'd love to find 5 men. There are about 5 main characters in Job. I'd love to find 5 men who would all learn a part each, verse by verse, and come to the Crescent some night and say the whole thing from beginning to end. Are you game? You don't look too enthusiastic. I would love to see someone, or even a Sunday school class, or somebody somewhere, actually sitting down with these various parts, you know, and just quote them at each other. And rather than these expositions of these verses, just quietly go through it. And you might catch the drift of the argument even more powerfully if 3 or 4 people could say it off by heart. But I don't see people queuing up for the idea. In fact, I'd love to be able to learn it all off myself and be able to code it. 3 verses a day? Well, we'll be going this time next year, I think, even at that rate. But oh, that I could just... beginning to end. I'd love to find 5 men. There are about 5 main characters in Job. I'd love to find 5 men who would all learn a part each, verse by verse, and come to the Crescent some night and say the whole thing from beginning to end. Are you game? You don't look too enthusiastic. I would love to see someone, or even a Sunday school class, or somebody somewhere, actually sitting down with these various parts, you know, and just coat them on each other. And rather than these expositions of these verses, just quietly go through it. And you might catch the drift of the argument even more powerfully if 3 or 4 people could say it off by heart. But I don't see people queuing up for the idea. In fact, I'd love to be able to learn it all off myself and be able to code it. 3 verses a day? Well, we'll be going this time next year, I think, even at that rate. But oh, that I could just take you to these characters. This man sitting purring away with all this traditional theology pouring out of him, you know. I'm so right, Job, and you're so wrong. I'm coding and blinding him with logic. You know, Mark Twain, they say, by logic, proved that he was his own grandfather. Work that out. You can prove anything by logic. Of course, he wasn't, but he proved it by logic. As far as logic was concerned, and when I was over here at Queen's, yes, that little place around the corner there, I had to do a year of logic. And I tell you, it was tough. It was a scream, actually, the things you could prove by logic when we were doing moral philosophy. I remember those moral philosophy classes, and I wasn't very good at math, so you can imagine my logic was away round the bend altogether. But we had to struggle through our exams and get on with it, and it was fascinating. This, because this is this, and that's that, and the other's the other. And it seems so logical, and it seems so right. But it was wrong. Now, Job, my friend, where are you? What are you going to say? Chapter 16. And you're very patient. I can't see down there whether you're asleep or not, you see, but you're listening very well. Always feel like the bishop, you know, who dreamt he was asleep while he was preaching and woke up and discovered he was. Well, I hope you're still with me. Chapter 16. Then Job answered. Now, how would you answer that kind of talk? Blinding him with logic. Against the insinuations, Job protests with an even greater indignation. He holds more tenaciously now to 2 facts. I'm not guilty of any grave fault, and God is entitled to do with me as he wants. But unfortunately, I have to face a problem in this chapter, folks, where poor Job feels that God is his enemy. Then he hurls here at the beginning Eliphaz's taunt back at him. I have heard, verse 2, many such things. Miserable comforters are you all. Shall vain words have an end? Or what emboldeneth thee that thou answerest? I also could speak as you do. If your soul were in my soul's stead, I could heap up words against you and shake my head at you. Job says, you know, I could switch places with you fellas and I could shake my head. If you were me, I could go look so holy. Shake my head and dear me. And I could talk the way you talk. He almost sounds Irish in this verse, doesn't he? You know, it's almost cheeky, but it's true. I could speak as you do. If your soul were in my soul's stead, I could heap up words against you and shake my head at you if we switched places. His speech is an incident rare in the book of Job, mind you. Let me say that Job now almost begins logically, but with more spiritual logic, as we shall see by the end, because out of the depths of this almost impossible chapter 16, we're going to see a tremendous truth. Believe it or not. Here Job is matching all Eliphaz's ideas line by line almost. It's about the only answer to an argument that you can match perfectly. He said this, Job said that, he said that argument, Job answered it this way. Job isn't always just as literally carrying the argument against his friends so clearly, point by point, as he is in this chapter. But that's a study in itself. In verses 2 to 5, we glance at Job's reply. Yes, yes, I admit he is sad. He is indignant. He is passionate. He is as sarcastic as ever he seemed to be over these past 2 months as we've studied him. And he even now begins to charge God again with inflicting these calamities on him unjustly. And it seems as if for the next 15, 20 minutes, I'm going to go through the same kind of thing again. But I'm not. Job, if we look more closely, has a radical change in this chapter. A radical change passes on him. He's now beginning, I'm glad to say, to grope his way through the darkness toward the light. He's disengaging himself from the irritating platitudes which his friends still cram into his ear. And he's rising to the amazing discovery that behind the God whom he, until this moment, has worshipped, there was a God whom he as yet hadn't known. And therefore there might be a light for him, even in the darkness of death itself, and hope beyond the grave. He's going to discover that God is more and different than what he thought he was. And because this hope that God may be different to what he's understood him to be up to this moment begins to rise in his breast and becomes out broader on his horizon of his thinking, changing his whole attitude and his spirit, his tone gets more calm and more collected. In fact, he now begins to treat these fellows with irony and sarcasm, but there's a lovely strain of sort of large-minded good humor with him and good sense. And he's incensed against what Eliphaz has been saying against him, and he doesn't agree with it, and what they say is true enough, but he says, if I were in your place, I would say the same and all that, but he's beginning to learn that he has to deal with two gods. Don't misunderstand me. The imaginary God of the current theology, trotted out by Eliphaz, who afflicts him because he hates him. God hates me, therefore he afflicts me. To a true discovery of the real and the true God, who loves him even when he afflicts him. The God who is witnessing to him in heaven, even when he strives with him on earth. The God who stands surety for him with himself and will vindicate him against himself. To this God, Job now begins to turn. The God who will vindicate him. And the God who, although he doesn't understand what he's doing to him, loves him all the time. He begins to appeal right now to this God, assured that God will justify him, even if it means in the life to come. Yes, of course he could have strung antique sentences together just like these fellas did and come out with all this stuff. Job is claiming that if their positions were exchanged, he could do much better than they had done in the role of the comforter. But verse 5 is very sarcastic, isn't it? But I would strengthen you with my mouth, and the moving of my lips would assuage your grief. If I was a comforter, if I was trying to be a comforter, I could make a much better job of it than you fellows have done so far. Now Job, at this point, declines to reopen the point of appealing to the voice of tradition and all the fellows in the past. He refuses to continue moving round and round in a narrowy circle, hemmed in by the thoughts of his friends. This larger thought. This thought that the true God is behind and beyond all of the poor conceptions he has had of him. that God may be, after all, his advocate begins to take over. And I admit to you that I'd find it very hard to prove that point in the opening verses we're about to read. But please remember, Job is a very sick man and his mind is fluctuating. But it's slowly coming through. It's a checkered expression. There are many shadows of doubt in this particular chapter, broken by outcries of despair. Yes, I admit that. But we must realize that it is out of the depths of despair that some of our truest and most sustaining hopes arise upon us. And I know that in a few moments he's about to accuse God of being his enemy, as if God were his enemy. But out of the depths of that thought, as he begins to think that God is really about to slaughter him, Job comes to express great truth. I was preaching on Sunday evening, and after I'd finished preaching, an elder of the church came and sat down, a man from another city. As he sat down there, he began to tell me how he had been wonderfully converted. Through the preaching of Billy Graham, he was a compulsive gambler, and he lost £700 in London one night in one gamble. And he wandered in to hear Billy, and Billy was preaching on why spendest thou money for that which is not bread. And this man was converted. He became a church elder in a denomination in Scotland, lived for the Lord for many years. Then he began to turn to drink, began to smoke heavily, began to get desperately depressed, couldn't read, couldn't pray. And he came wandering into Motherwell on Saturday night, and he was wandering around, and he said, "Oh God," he said, "could I find somewhere where I could go, where I could worship you or praise the Lord or something?" And he saw the sign for our meetings, and he came in, and he went up to the fellow on the door. He said, "Could I praise the Lord in here?" And your man nearly caught him by the neck and by the leg and threw him in. He said, "This is the place for you, sir." He brought him in with a welcome. And you know, I find an amazing thing. It's amazing what God brings even when you're on these passages. That man was pouring out to me the problems he had. Oh, his life was filled with problems as a Christian. He had terrible depression. He had gone, slipped away back, just like Alan Redpath told us he had done in the first 7 years of his Christian life. And he was in an awful place. And it was as if he wondered if he was a Christian at all. And I let him talk, you know, and he talked and he poured it all out for quite a while. And then suddenly, in the midst of everything, as I was beginning to counsel him, he looked at me, he said, "Of course," he said, I would rather have Jesus than anything, you know." I said, "What was that you said, sir?" In the midst of all his despair, as he was pouring out, no, he couldn't pray, and yes, he was away from God, and was he a Christian at all? In the midst of his despair, he said, "Oh, but I'd rather have Jesus than anything." I said, "That's one of the loveliest testimonies," I said in my mind, and I think I said it to him, "that I've heard for a long time." Sometimes when you're in the depths of despair and the whole of life seems to be caving in, you discover where you really are. Is there somebody like that here tonight? The devil's got the hold of you. Maybe you've had miserable comforters like these fellows coming around you with their mere traditions and philosophies and talk, and they haven't helped you at all. But you know the Lord. And although tonight your life may seem to be in ruins, and everything's going wrong in your life, and you've maybe failed exams, or your girlfriend's given you up, or maybe you've given him up, or he's given you up, or whatever, let me get it right. Or maybe an engagement broken tonight, or maybe a business collapsed. I don't know who I'm talking to. I never know who turns up in these meetings. Is there someone listening to me tonight? And may I be a true servant of God? May I bring a word from the Lord to you, my friend? May you find what Job found in the midst of his despair. And he had said hard things about God, and he's about to say hard things about God. Let's look at them. But let me just ask you, if you were in Job's position, what would you have said? How would you have expressed that maybe behind all the calamities that have happened to me, that God has allowed, there is a God who really will work everything out in my life for good in the end? And that although I am ill, I mean, Good Friday, I went preaching on Good Friday to the city hospital. I don't know what their two names are. One was called Sadie, and I think the other was Dorothy. And I went in, and I know City, she's been lying there for 18 years in the city hospital in the same bed. I said, "City, how are you?" Good Friday it was, and I had a wee chat with her, and she was praising the Lord, and she's great. She said, "That's my friend Dorothy over there." So I went over to Dorothy, and I said, "Hello, Dorothy, how are you? How long have you been here?" 18 years, she said. I said, 18 years, Dorothy? I said, are you here as long as City? Oh, no, she said, "City came in a day earlier than me." And she grinned. Oh, you could have knocked me over with a feather. 18 years. And as Dorothy lay there, she couldn't move her own head. She literally couldn't do that. Totally paralyzed. She could speak. She could hear. She says, "I can speak and I can hear and I can see." And she says, "I see and I hear far too much, to tell you the honest truth." And I thought, wow. That's really something. "I really can't hear, you know," she says, "but I hear too much." And those two women there, you know, they ministered to me spiritually. I went out of that place and I sort of, you know, moved my hand, you know. Just to do that, to turn over a page. She can't even turn over a page. Can't wipe her own nose. Can't take a tear away from her own eye. She can't move! And she's been there for 18 years! Was she filled with despair? Was she filled with horrible things, saying about everybody? Not at all. She was a joy to talk to. I'll tell you that I went home and, you know, I sat down and lifted a cup of coffee and I thought, what a joy even to be able to lift a cup of coffee. Love one now, actually, but there it is. Just to be able to do that. And maybe if you had been in Job's position, you may not have been like City and Dorothy. You may have behaved another way altogether. Please bring to these statements sympathy. Sympathy. Don't be hard on old Job as he now begins to talk. Sympathy, please. And then we'll feel and find what he's getting through to. What does he say? Verse 6 to 17. "Though I speak, is my grief not assuaged, and though I forbear, what am I eased? But now he hath made me weary." That's God. "Thou hast made me desolate. All my company. You've taken my friends and my family away. Thou hast filled me with wrinkles, which is a witness against me. And my leanness rising up in me beareth witness to my face." Worse still, he even sees himself being a traitor to himself. His diseased and emaciated body bears witness against him, confessing, as it were, that he is and he must be a sinner, and that really he is sick and ill and he has all these problems because he's wicked. But his conscience acquits him. He knows he has not. He has made sacrifices for his sins and he has not sinned. He knows in his conscience that's what it is. And he holds his innocence to the very end. He believed that in the end God had allowed it to happen, you see. And that it wasn't his wickedness that had brought it to him. But his body doesn't really say that to him. He's filled with wrinkles and emaciated, and his body seems to be witnessing against him. "He teareth me in his wrath, who hateth me. He gnasheth upon me with his teeth, mine enemy sharpeneth his eyes upon me. They have gaped upon me with their mouth. They have smitten me upon the cheek reproachfully. They have gathered themselves together against me. God hath delivered me to the ungodly and turned me over into the hands of the wicked. I was at ease, but he hath broken me asunder. He hath also taken me by my neck and shaken me to pieces and set me up for his mark." Verse 9, he describes the terrible onset of the furious leader. The anger, the gnashing teeth, the flaming eyes. Verse 10, you have the pack howling behind his feet with gaping jaws, shameless gestures, hungry hate against him. Verse 11, God's scornful abandonment of the stunned and bleeding prey to leave them to the hounds coming behind. Bitterness in these verses. Impossible that Job should not be cut to the very quick as he saw his friends that he had trusted and the clan with which he had been honored chieftain turned vehemently against him. Job had fallen from the top of happy days to the very bottom of loss and misery, but It gave a new and keener edge to his misery. The evidence of his decline was all around him. The people he looked to for sympathy and help, it wasn't there. And mind you, I'll say from verse 9 to verse 11, the more I study them, although God, he feels to be his chief foe, verse 9 and 11, that description of the human pack at his heels is so graphic that it sort of draws your attention away from God acting like that to him as though it were his friends acting like that to him. The pack seems to be his friends from verse 9 to verse 11. Although God is, he feels, is his chief foe. Then from verse 12 to verse 16, Job calls our thoughts away from men to God, his chief antagonist, setting forth the divine enmity he feels that God has against him in figures which successively indicate the unexpected violence and destructiveness that God had allowed. God hath delivered me to the ungodly. Verse 12, I was at ease, but he hath broken me asunder. He hath taken me by my neck. He hath shaken me to pieces. He hath set me up for his mark. His archers compass me round about. He cleaveth my reins asunder and doth not spare. He poureth out my gall upon the ground. He breaketh me with breach upon breach. He runneth upon me like a giant. I have sewed sackcloth upon my skin and defiled my face in the dust. My face is foul with weeping, and on my eyelids is the shadow of death. A literal translation of those verses, can I give it to you? I was at ease, and he shattered me. He grabbed my gullet and smashed me. He set me up as his target, and his archers encircled me. He chopped my kidneys unsparingly. He spilt my gall on the ground. He wounds me with wound upon wound. He rushed against me like a champion. And in verse 14, it says, like I was a fair edifice, a lovely building, and he broke me in pieces, breach upon breach. And my very face is defiled in the dust. It was once high and honored head, and now it's down in the dust with sorrow and shame. My very face is inflamed, verse 16, with crying. And the shadow of death darkens my eyelids. That's how he feels that God has acted towards him. Is there somebody like that here tonight and you feel that's just the way the Lord has handled you? You feel that he's just broken you, pieces. Like some I know in this place, they say, I can't take any more, Lord. I have known Christians, even in fellowship in this assembly within the last 6 months, who have been saying that, I can't take any more, Lord. My problems are so great, I just can't take any more. Are you like that? And your mind begins to go along this line. Hey, God must be against me. He must really hate me. Or does he? He's giving the thought to this. And you say, will he stand? What about all this, Derek, you said earlier about groping through to hope that God, maybe the God he had thought of as his enemy wasn't his enemy after all. Ah, that's where it comes now. His household, his clan, his servants, his God, even his very self seems to condemn himself. They're all against him. Can he stand? Yes, he can. Verse number 17. And we don't have time to go into chapter 17 tonight. I would have taken about 5 or 10 minutes on that. We'll do that next week. It just finishes the argument, and I'll deal with it in more depth next week. But verse 17. Not for any injustice in mine hands. Also my prayer is pure. O earth, cover not thou my blood, and let my cry have no place. Also now behold my witness. My witness is in heaven, and my record is on high. Hey, Job, what are you saying? My friends scorn me, but mine eye poureth out tears unto God. Now you're talking, Job. Oh, that one might plead for a man with God as a man pleadeth for his neighbor. What's he saying now? Well, all this has come upon me, he's saying, and upon me by the will of God, but still I will stand to it. I have not deserved it. There has been no violence in my hands. Notice verse 17. Not any injustice in my hands. No violence in my hands. And my worship has been sincere. I have been sincere in the way I have worshipped the Lord. Where's the new tone then? For this seems to be very familiar territory of Job. Well, it breaks in on us from verse 18 to verse 22. If Job, my friends, listening tonight, and you're listening so well, if Job is not to sink to bottomless despair, if any remnant of faith and courage is to be left in him, he's got to struggle upward to a love and a justice higher than he has hitherto known. He must reach up to a God higher than he's yet conceived, or else he's finished. If he goes on with this idea he's been on earlier in the chapter about God being his enemy, there's no hope for him. In his mind at this time is a God who has stripped him of health and wealth and friends. And whither can Job turn from him? If he can turn anywhere, he can only turn from the hostile God, whom he knows only too well, to the loving God, whose ways are so large and wise as they are totally inscrutable to him. And he turns from God, the God of current theology, to the God of the conscience and the God of the heart. And to this God he begins to make his appeal. And with a tremendous boldness of faith and despair together, he believes, yes, he says, I will believe, that God will avenge me. And he'll avenge the very blood that he himself has shed in my life. O earth, cover not thou, verse 18, my blood, and let my cry have no place. God may seem to be the foe who thrusts for poor Job's destruction, but nevertheless he must be a friend who will save and vindicate him. And up until now, the thought of his unrecognized and unavailing innocence has certainly driven Job through all these terrible problems. But it's driven him nearly frantic. I am innocent, yet I can't understand what God's doing. And he held to his innocence. That's what the book of Job is all about here. But you see, it nearly held him to utter despair. And this point, and it's so important in the argument, this point, he has always hitherto lost his self-command and broken out in wild talk, reproaches against God handling him so unjustly. But it now leads him to see that behind the God whose face is clouded with anger, as he sees him then, there must be a God whose aspect is bright. That he need not appeal to men against God, but he may press straight on to God himself. He needn't tax himself anymore to look for some day far distant in which his integrity will be answered, but that perhaps God would answer his integrity now and prove his innocence. That's the thought that gives him such a profound word in verse 19. Behold, my witnesses in heaven and my records on high. God is watching me. And the God of current theology and the God that I have seen up until now, why, he's far greater than that. He's not like that at all. He's actually taking my record on high, and he's my witness in heaven. It's so strange, isn't it? But it's so welcome to Job. It's so accurately true. He was absolutely right. This is the great turning point for Job here as his friends come against him. This is a great provision of faith here. God was always witnessing to him on high and actually praising him, as he never cursed God, even though he had these thoughts and wondered what God was up to. It's like a new star on Job's horizon, the thought of a just God and a Savior. It's so clear, and it's so true to him, that even already in verse number 20, instead of appealing as up until now from God to man, he appeals from man to the God he has discovered. My friends scorn me, but mine eye pours out my fears unto God. Oh, it's fantastic, tremendous truth this. These men may mock Job's innocence, so he turns from them to this God that has been freshly revealed to him, and he appeals to him with streaming tears, which testify at once to his misery and to his sincerity. And for what does he appeal? Verse 21. Oh, that one might plead for a man with God as a man pleadeth for his neighbor. Please, Lord, he says, justify me. Please justify me. I'm pleading before you, not before men. And I want to trust in you, Lord. I know you'll listen to me. I know you'll respond to me. I know that you will not let me down. And in verse 22, you know, Job wrings from his very misery a plea that God shouldn't delay on vindicating him. as he presses for immediate help. When a few years are come, then I shall go the way whence I shall not return. I'm going to die soon, Lord. Would you not vindicate me now? And I just leave the Spirit of God tonight to apply that to your heart. Don't close your notes yet. I'm almost finished. Just let me say to you as I close, with a word of God in my hand, maybe the God that you have thought of up until so far, and the God that you have worshipped, he is more than you think he is. And the God you thought that was so against you is not against you at all. And he has allowed these dreadful circumstances in your life to bring you closer to himself. I am discovering in the book of Job things about God I never dreamt of. That God would actually allow Job to say all those things about him and let him pour it all out as if God were cutting him in pieces. And say all those things about God as if, God, you're my enemy. And then at the end of his despair, bring him to this point where he goes up through to his witness in heaven. The God who is not his enemy, but the God who is his Savior. Oh, that you could see tonight that the God that we preach is a God who loves. And through those narrow circumstances and big problems in your life, he's doing a great thing. I have to apply this to a circumstance even in my life today. I have to look up to heaven and say, well, Lord, you know best, Lord. I'm not half as bad as Job is yet in my circumstances, and yet you allowed it. And Lord, you're guiding, and you are pushing the way through for me, right through the most greatest labyrinth of problems. And I know this book's a mind-bender. Do you not think it's a mind-bender? I'm going to take a trip to the Caribbean after I get through it, I'm telling you. Or somewhere. It is causing me to study like I have never studied in my life. Please don't think it's easy. It's not. Here are some of the most profound things in the universe. But God has put them there to let you see a man go through just mere theology to the reality of himself. And if you find God in a new way and learn to trust God even as this poor man did, even against all the mere philosophies and platitudes of men, you break through to that. This series will be worth every moment. May God reveal his truth to you. Shall we pray?